Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the people I admire most in that battle space is our first guest, Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, blogger par excellence at dianawest.net, and best-selling author of Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, the secret assault on our nation's character. Diana, welcome. Always good to have you with us, but most especially today.
Well, thank you, Frank. Good to be with you as always.
I say most especially today because you have just recently written a very important piece about why nations extinguish themselves. And before we get to the thrust of that piece and how we are in the process of extinguishing ourselves, I want to talk about an institution that I used to serve in and love, namely the United States Senate, which seems to be in the process of extinguishing itself as well. Talk a little bit about the decision of, most especially, 11 Republican members of the Senate yesterday to vote down a piece of legislation, an amendment offered by Senator Ron Johnson that would have required what the president is cooking up with Iran to be handled as a treaty requiring a two-thirds majority vote in favor to be approved by the United States Senate.
Yes, well, this proposal would have been a splendid addition to our national security and also the cause of democratic government. We would have seen whether the Senate could have mustered the required 67 votes to approve such a treaty as required. And yet we see the spectacle, and I call it a spectacle, and I think that's actually a nice word for it, of 11 Republicans voting to cede their constitutional powers back to the executive branch. In other words, voting themselves into the inert state of being a rubber stamp.
My exact thought. And to the extent that they're doing this, it is contributing to truly the extinguishing of the Senate as a check and balance, as a means of quality control for this constitutional republic. Because, as you know so well, Diana, the framers understood that you could mutate the Constitution through treaties. And as we'll be talking about in the course of the program, not just in this context, but also later with Rick Manning about this trade promotion authority business, we may be seeing the Senate essentially, as you say, reduced to more or less a blank check for this president rather than a check and balance. And Diana, to the extent that we're witnessing this playing out, how does this fit into the larger problem that you've described of the nation itself perhaps in the process of extinguishing itself?
It's more evidence of the betrayal of our nation, of our institutions, coming from the very side, the right, conservatives, the Republican Party, that one would expect to stand up for these very institutions and indeed for the nation. The left does what the left does best, that is collectivize, centralize power, attempt to change the Constitution into something that it was not intended to be, intending to make the president into a kind of dictator or king or imperial power. This is what we're living through. And when we see surrender coming from our own side, which I would call this spectacle of the 11 senators voting against making the Iran deal a treaty, this makes the betrayal all the worse because we're not just fighting in a good, clean fight to preserve the Constitution. We are actually from within, by our own hand, to borrow a phrase, destroying ourselves. And this is how nations extinguish themselves. It's not from the external threat. It's not from political opposition. It's from our own surrender, our own moral cowardice on our own side. And this is what makes it so painful and also what makes it so speedy.
You have, of course, referred there to a phrase taken from a Muslim Brotherhood strategy document. It was called the Explanatory Memorandum on the General Strategic Goal of the Group in North America, dated 1991, which explicitly says the mission of the Muslim Brotherhood is to destroy Western civilization from within by their hands, and meaning ours. And Diana, this is particularly apt because today, a paragon of courage, a man you and I both admire tremendously, Geert Wilders, a Dutch parliamentarian, is to be meeting with people in the United States Congress. I myself plan to be there. I trust you will be as well. But the point is that this individual was kept from coming to Britain a few years back, and two members of Congress with long ties to the Muslim Brotherhood themselves. I'm speaking of Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison and Indiana Congressman Andre Carson. Have tried to keep him out of the United States as well. What is up with that? And for that matter, what is up with the fact that Nancy Pelosi put this Muslim Brotherhood-tied individual, Andre Carson, on the House Intelligence Committee?
Well, these are good questions, and if we had a functioning Congress, we would actually have investigations to answer these questions. We have to sit on the outside and glean what we can and do what kinds of investigations we can. But, I mean, this is staggering, just watching these things fall into place. And when you actually see them trying to flex their muscles and prevent Geert Wilders from coming to the United States, coming to the Congress, it just makes it clear how emboldened these forces are and how dangerous that is. Now, I fully expect here to come and to speak and to have a wonderful event sponsored by Representatives Louis Gohmert and Steve King, both fine Republicans who champion liberty and champion Wilders. So what is it all about? Well, it's a symbol and it's a marker and it's a way of taking this fight forward, and it's very dangerous, and we just have to be all the more vigilant here in terms of exposing them, of discussing what's going on, of trying to make it clear to people what kind of game is being played. This is the extinction of speech, political will, and will to survive. What Wilders does in Europe is what I wish someone would do here, which is stand up for his country within his borders, his national culture, his national government, his entire patrimony. And we do not really see many politicians in America conceive of America in these terms. This is the effect of globalism, multiculturalism, and so on, which is so conditioned, even well-meaning politicians and pundits to fail in these same ways. And that's why Wilders is so special, and he is having stunning successes over the years. Given the vilification campaigns against him, it's astonishing how his party continues to grow and continues to be at or near the top of the Dutch political polls. We may someday, in a good world, see him form a coalition government and be prime minister. I mean, this is not outside the realm of possibility.
From your lips to God's ears, it's certainly needed in his country, and as is his example in ours. I would trade all 11 of these members of the Senate who voted essentially to give Iran the bomb, effectively, for this one courageous Dutch parliamentarian, if it could be arranged. We'll be looking forward, as program airs, we will have had the opportunity to visit with Geert, and I hope that we'll have him on the show again soon. But Diana, lastly, just a quick question. As the Senate was voting to essentially allow Iran to get the bomb through this process, it had seized a vessel that America apparently has a responsibility to protect. I think it's the case that it was flagged by the Marshall Islands. If this is how Iran is behaving without the bomb, what might we expect, briefly, when they get it?
Aggression. Hostility, violence, mayhem, annihilation, in a nutshell.
That's brief and very much to the point, and I fear we're all on notice about this. This is not going to be a mystery if it does in fact play out. The Iranians couldn't have done more. Really, not since Adolf Hitler, I think, have we seen anybody telegraph their punches quite as dramatically about such horrific intentions as have the Iranian mullahs. Diana, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We will, of course, be watching this space and watching most especially your outstanding blog at dianawest.net. Keep up the great work and most especially your efforts to help us all understand the magnitude, the extent, and the implications of the ongoing American betrayal. Next up, Matt Brodsky joins us. We'll talk with him a bit about this Iran business and most especially the implications of our government giving Iran tens of billions of dollars, even as it behaves in this fashion and threatens worse. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states. One that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz for the Center for Security Policy. Over the last week, it has become clear that the so-called framework agreement announced by the Obama administration to bring about a comprehensive nuclear deal with Iran is in deep trouble. Iranian officials have disagreed with the Obama administration's account of the framework, especially over verification and sanctions relief. Contrary to U.S. claims that there will be strict verification and phased sanctions relief, Iranian leaders have said verification efforts will be limited, with military facilities off limits. They also insist that sanctions must be completely terminated, not suspended, once a final agreement is signed. So if there was not agreement on the framework, what's going on here? The likely explanation is that the framework is a fraud to stop Congress from passing legislation imposing new sanctions on Iran or requiring a congressional vote on a final nuclear agreement. It is my hope Congress will not be fooled by this obvious fraud. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Matt Brodsky. He is today a senior analyst at Wikistrat. He formerly was the director of policy for the highly regarded Jewish Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and editor of JPC's journal In Focus Quarterly. He was also associated for a time as a Legacy Heritage Fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council. Always welcome here. Matt, good to have you back.
Good to be with you.
Well, you have been following closely the machinations with respect to Iran, aimed ostensibly at keeping them from getting the bomb. The Senate of the United States, as we were talking about a moment ago with Diana West, has decided not to exercise the kind of authority that the Constitution gives it on a treaty. And what I'm really struck by is that at the same time this is happening, that it's sort of creating a blank check for the president on this bomb business. Iran is seizing what it thought was an American vessel in the Strait of Hormuz. Matt Brodsky, if this is how they're behaving before they get the bomb, what is it likely to be like once they have it?
It's going to be incredibly bad, especially with the infusion of money that we're going to provide for them, a $50 billion signing bonus. And there's no way that we have any assurance as to where the money that they're going to get is to be spent. So for the White House to try to claim that, well, the money won't go to their nuclear program or it won't go to supporting terrorism, which is what they do, just as that's their reason, that's because they support terrorism.
Who they are.
Right. So to claim that that money won't be spent that way, when you look at the arms coming in to Gaza, when you look at the arms coming in and their own personnel going into Syria, into Lebanon, it's a fantasy to believe that it all won't be spent in terrorism. And they're already doing that today, and that's without a cash windfall. And let's not also forget that this latest, the deal with the Maersk Tigris ship, this also follows an incident from Friday when Iranian warships surrounded, but they didn't board, another large Maersk ship. It was the U.S.-flagged Kensington. So this is they're essentially acting like pirates now, like Somali pirates, and it's an indication of how they're going to act once a deal is signed.
And their current contempt for us, which can only be increased by our conduct in the meantime. Matt Brodsky is our guest. He is a senior analyst at Wikistrat and a serious student of matters involving the Middle East and notably what is afoot at the moment with respect to Iran. And you have been writing some very important, sort of warning articles about what seems to be afoot, Matt, with respect to this idea that we will continue to have some kind of sanctions regime on the Iranians, and to the extent that it is in fact eased or dismantled, whether conditionally or otherwise, that not to worry, the administration assures us, they will all snap back into place. What is going on here, and should we credit this at all, given what we know is afoot at the moment?
The snapback sanctions are a fiction. It's literally an economic tooth fairy. There are no mechanisms for sanctions to snap back. And here you have to understand the different types of sanctions there are. First of all, the United States sanctions. We already let up on some, and that's what brought Iran to the table. Those were really effective sanctions. But there are ones passed through the president through executive order, so he just makes his own, and there are ones through Congress. Most of the sanctions the United States has with regards to Iran has to do with all kinds of other behavior, including their support of terrorism, weapons proliferation, human rights. And these are wrapped into a large sanctions package through Congress. So it would literally force the president, according to the law, to come to Congress and say, okay, they've stopped supporting terrorism. Well, as we know from the previous segment and what's happening in Yemen, they're not going to stop their support of terrorism. So you can't. The president can't just take away congressional sanctions. And on an international level, the United Nations, the six Security Council resolutions that have been passed with 12 years of painstaking efforts from the international community, once those erode, that provides the that is what the European Union and the rest of the world looks to keep their sanctions in place. Once they're gone, they're gone. They're going to have businesses that are already lined up to do business, whether official business such as Russia selling the S-300 missile system or China wanting to sell nuclear, basically to build up their nuclear program after the deal, they're going to have businesses rushing in, and that pressure on European governments is not, that's not going to be able to snap back, and the U.S. will have no control over it, so we'll go to the United Nations, and who is going to have veto power there? Vladimir Putin.
And the Chinese, as well as the British and French, for that matter, if they choose to exercise them. So, Matt, just to give us a sense of the magnitude of this problem, as I understand it, quite apart from the sanctions, and I think you're right, they are eroding as we speak. The president seems intent upon removing the ones that he can, and they seem, as I understand it, to include some congressional sanctions, at least, which have waiver authorities for the president. But quite apart from all of that, there's supposed to be, even absent the signing bonus, something on the order of $12 billion that we will have transferred in this current phase of negotiations. And then the possibility of another, as you have indicated, $30, maybe $50 billion for signing some sort of deal. And you really have struck what I think is the most important point. That is, this will migrate, whether it's simply through the fungibility of money or whether it's through direct transfers, into a whole host of activities that are inimical to American security. In fact, we have a spot that we released today that talks about this. You can check it out at irantruth.org or at securefreedom.org, folks. It's a powerful point made that there's not only this problem with the Iranians, of course, there's also the problem with the United States Senate going along with what President Obama is trying to do. Hey, Matt, let me switch gears with you in the last minute or two we've got. You've also been worrying properly about another problem in the Middle East, and that is the efforts that the Palestinians are making. Again, it seems once more emboldened by our own government to think that the UN can be used as a means of essentially end-running negotiations with Israel and achieving a longstanding goal of a Palestinian state. Tell us the latest on that, and what role is the U.S. government playing in that regard at the moment?
Well, this is part of the Palestine 194 plan, which is to become the 194th state recognized at the UN. And this has been a longstanding plan. So, of course, it is to circumvent negotiations with Israel. The goal is to vilify, isolate, and persecute Israel at the International Criminal Court. And essentially, if you claim to support their statehood, those who do, this initiative doesn't help. It perpetuates the conflict. It keeps the conflict going because it requires nothing of them. They just get to sit back and wait for more pressure to be applied to Israel. While nothing happens, they pay absolutely no price. That absolutely must change. Now, the United States part, since Netanyahu has been reelected, is to say that perhaps they will support UN resolutions that force the framework on Israel and the Palestinians. Who knows if either side would accept that? I doubt either side would go for it. But it's a dangerous area where a president who has so misread the region on almost every single issue would be laying down a framework for peace.
Right. It really raises the question, and we'll be talking about it more momentarily with Rick Manning, about whether anything that this president touches in the way of an international negotiation or effort to achieve some sort of international understanding can be trusted, can be seen to be in the national interests of the United States. And it gives me no pleasure to say this. Unfortunately, I don't see any evidence that that's the case. Matt Brodsky, your insights into what is happening and likely to happen in the Middle East are greatly appreciated by all of us here at Secure Freedom Radio. I hope you will come back to us again soon. Keep up in the meantime the good work you are currently engaged in at Wikistrat. As I mentioned, Rick Manning's up next on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What to expect from it and what to do about it. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're all part of your community.
We all play a role in keeping our community safe.
So protect your everyday.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. 11 Republican senators voted yesterday for Iran to get the bomb. Oh, they won't admit to doing so, but that's the practical effect of their vote against Senator Ron Johnson's amendment to require that the agreement supposed to prevent that outcome take the form of a treaty. If it doesn't, the Senate will be reduced to a rubber stamp for whatever President Obama serves up. That ensures it will be an accord that legitimates, not prevents, Iran's nuclear weapons program. The 11 senators' appalling lack of courage contrasts sharply to the fortitude of someone visiting Capitol Hill today, Dutch parliamentarian Geert Wilders. Jihadists want to murder him for his indefatigable resistance to Iranian and others' supremacist Islam. I'd trade all of the odious 11 for one Geert Wilders in the Senate today. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It is a distinct pleasure to have with us men I've come to admire tremendously for the contributions he's making at the moment and has made for quite some time to American politics and policy, much of it, but not all, affecting our national security and certainly our national interests. He is Richard Manning. He is the president today of a wonderful group, Americans for Limited Government. Prior to joining ALG, he served as the public affairs chief at the U.S. Department of Labor during the George W. Bush administration, was with the National Rifle Association for many years, and has columns that appear in The Hill, Investors, Business Daily, Fox News, and elsewhere. Rick, it is great to have you with us, sir. I am so pleased that particularly on the day that the Japanese prime minister addressed a joint session of Congress and spoke at some length and quite volubly about the importance of this Trans-Pacific partnership, that we can do a little bit of truth squatting with you, as you've taken a very skeptical view, as have I, of this deal. First, talk with us a little bit about what this so-called TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, is shaping up to be about.
Well, Frank, thanks for having me, first of all. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a deal that's been put together, a treaty that's been put together by President Obama and 11 other countries, including Japan. It's ostensibly a trade deal. But the challenge with it is this, Frank. It actually has about 22 sections of it have nothing to do with trade. They regulate every aspect of the world economy. So it's really what Bloomberg has called a regulatory deal, not a trade deal. And Congress is in the process of trying to decide how they're going to vote on that trade deal. Are they going to give President Obama a pathway to passage by lowering the barriers for how many votes he would need to pass it to a simple majority, both the Senate and the House? Or will they go when they require the two-thirds majority to get a ratification in the Senate? That is the normal procedure for a treaty. So that's the battle that's going on right now. And having the Prime Minister of Japan speaking before Congress is part of the plan to sell America that this trade deal is a good deal.
Let's come back to the merits of it in a moment. But just, I guess, first of all, a technical question. Is the deal done? And if it is done, what do we know about what's in it? It certainly seems to me as though this has been kind of a black box, even as best I can tell for members of the Congress. Is that right?
I think that's really an accurate way of portraying it. It's a secret deal. In order to see the details of it, you have to have at least a secret clearance. It is not completed yet. It's 5.5 years in the making. And it's a deal that has been said to be about 99% completed, but it is not yet completed. As a result, it is very difficult for members of Congress to go and see it and spend time with it, take it home, figure it out. They can't have their staff look at it. And quite honestly, they're being asked to vote for a pig in a poke in terms of this deal because they really don't know what it contains. And what's more, and this is the scary part, Frank, the deal is, according to comments by Jeff Sessions, the deal is portrayed as a living document, which means that even if it had been released and we all could read it, tomorrow, after ratification, the president could, in fact, make changes to it without congressional consent.
Well, this certainly sounds familiar, with the president rewriting things left and right. But I don't think I've ever heard of such an arrangement whereby, if there are changes to agreements, I mean, there are all kinds of precedents for amending deals or even treaties, but they require a congressional involvement and approval afterwards when that happens. But Rick, what you've described here, and especially if the black box has essentially been filled and what is being, you know, negotiated in it, is something that is redolent of a crony capitalism. Who has been actually involved in the negotiations? As I understand it, it's lots of special interests, and not altogether clear that the American public's interest is being very well represented. What are your thoughts on that point?
Well, I think it's exactly on point. Many of us have been very concerned about the pervasive influence of special interests here in Washington, D.C., and the rise of crony capitalism, where the business interests have a vested interest in big government because they are essentially the enablers and the people who do the vending for big government. So you have this kind of duality that occurs. Well, those same international corporations have had their representatives at the table working on this deal. We know that for certain because of WikiLeaks, actually. They released some documents from Sony that specifically were talking about concerns about this deal and leveraging different people to lobby on their behalf to make changes to the deal, promising support if they got what they wanted. And lo and behold, Hollywood came out in favor of the deal just a few weeks ago. So this is a wholesale attempt to create a trade deal that, because two things, number one, other countries can join the trade deal, including China, without Congress approving it. That's number one. So you do this negotiation, China says, I want in. The president says, yep, we'll let you in. And suddenly China's part of the trade deal without congressional approval.
Bait and switch, as they say.
Yes. And secondly, after the fact, the politicians can rearrange benign language in the deal to make it so it has specific beneficiary impact on corporate world, but also negative regulatory impact on Americans.
Wow. So this is the living feature of it, that it could become quite the living monster. Frankenstein comes to mind. But let me just ask you, because one of the other pieces of this, and you alluded to it earlier, Rick Manning, and again, our guest is the president of Americans for Limited Government, is a so-called fast-track treatment by the Congress, which essentially would take this out of the realm, much as the Senate has just agreed to do with respect to this Iran deal, out of the realm of a treaty that would require fully two-thirds of the Senate to approve it, and essentially remand it to an up-or-down, take-it-or-leave-it vote by the Congress, which, again, seems to be more or less just a rubber-stamp kind of process. Americans for Limited Government has begun running ads, as I understand it, in New Hampshire, raising concerns about this so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Trade Promotion Authority, focusing on Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and Rand Paul, three declared candidates for the presidency. What is the concern there, most especially with a man I've come to admire greatly, Ted Cruz, given a recent op-ed he had in the Wall Street Journal with Paul Ryan?
Well, it's very easy for Republican candidates to kind of mouth the words of free trade and talk about how important free trade is. And I agree with free trade, but I also believe that you have to actually look at what's in that treaty and not just read the headline that says, oh, this is a free trade treaty, so hence I'm a Republican, so hence I've got to support it. I mean, that's such a shallow way of looking at things. And when you look behind the curtain of what's in this treaty, you have to come to a simple conclusion. And it's one that Orrin Hatch, who supports this treaty, admitted. He said just yesterday in the Washington Times that it requires some trust. You have to trust Obama. And, you know, I'm sorry, but I've paid attention for the last 6 years. I don't know what Senator Hatch has been doing. And the one thing I know is that I can trust Obama to push his will over the Constitution. I've seen him push his will in terms of expanding climate change. I've seen the massive problems with the Iranian nuke deal, where they come up with a framework that not even the Iranians can agree with, and basically turn a blind eye to an existential threat, not just to Israel, but to our own country in terms of nuclear Iran. I see the China climate deal, that where he puts our country at an economic disadvantage with 16 years of diminishing economic capacity while letting China continue to pursue a complete economic growth model that includes burning any kind of energy they want to.
Yeah, and from which we're downwind, by the way. You could throw on the Bergdahl deal with the Taliban. I mean, there really isn't an agreement that President Obama has done that would warrant trusting him with something as important as this. And I think, Rick, I think influential thing you've said of the many important notes you've struck is this is actually a regulatory arrangement, not a trade deal. It should be considered carefully and vetted thoroughly by the Congress, in my estimation. Thank you for the work that you're doing at Americans for Limited Government to try to make that case, and I hope you'll keep it up and come back to us again very soon. And Corcoran joins us next. We'll talk about the new Europeans now washing up on Europe's shores, what that means for them and for us, and the new Americans the government here wants us to embrace. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGT. SullivanCenter.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back and joined by Ann Corcoran, the editor of Refugee Resettlement Watch, a woman who has really transformed herself by hard work and extraordinary writing abilities into one of the country's go-to authorities on the issue of how we are bringing hundreds of thousands of people, many of them Muslim and not a few jihadists, into this country under something known as the Refugee Resettlement Program. She is the author of a brand new monograph, I'm very pleased to say, published by the Center for Security Policy Press, entitled Refugee Resettlement and the Hijra to America. Anne, welcome back. It's good to have you with us as always.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Frank.
Much in the news at the moment, Ann, is a refugee resettlement program of a kind, rather ad hoc and not altogether legal, but nonetheless very much in the public eye, a humanitarian disaster, it's being described as, by which untold numbers of people, many of them from sub-Saharan Africa, some from Northern Africa, are now migrating to Europe in boats, rickety boats, or being washed overboard or what have you. What are the insights for us in terms of what is happening now in Europe as it tries to cope with this refugee influx and do so in a way that, again, many are encouraging us to follow suit on?
Frank, it's really quite tragic. It's tragic for not only the refugees or even the illegal aliens, if you will, whose lives are lost in this, but it's tragic for Europe, and it's tragic because there is no will in European Union to stop this. It's really quite an outrage. Tens of thousands of migrants are crossing over from those failed states like Libya to Europe. Who knows who are in these boats? But even if there's not a single terrorist, the economic impact on Europe is just profound. Let me just say that Australia has figured out what to do. The Abbott government, not new anymore, but the Abbott government is turning the boats back. And frankly, that is all that will save Europe now, is to turn those boats back to the North African coast.
They don't, as you say, seem to have the will to do it. And the question really is, are numbers of those people likely to wind up here as well, including some notably who've arrived in a place called Malta, an island off the coast of the continent of Europe?
Yeah, one of the things that has outraged me, and I followed this for 7 years, and it began in the Bush administration, is that a large number of these migrants land on the island of Malta, one of the first pieces of land they get to. And Malta is being besieged by the numbers. And for some inexplicable reason, the Bush administration decided about 7 years ago to start bringing in quote-unquote refugees from Malta. These are really illegal aliens that landed on the island of Malta. It is not the European Union's problem. It is not our problem. It is outside the normal refugee process to be doing this. And it's beyond me to understand why we started to do this. Who are these illegal aliens landing on Malta that end up in our towns and cities in the United States?
Yeah, and I want to cover a couple of different aspects of this. I know you've just recently completed a tour of some of the towns in which refugees are being deposited up in Minnesota. Trey Gowdy, the chairman of the Immigration and Border Security Subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee in the Congress, has recently expressed concern about a number of these migrants coming to Spartanburg in his district. There is a growing concern, I think, and you've really helped us all understand why we should be concerned about this, about who these people are, about our ability to vet them, about the number that are Muslim, and that's not necessarily a problem, but if they're coming from places where Sharia is kind of the norm and they seek to impose it here, including possibly violently, that is a problem. Talk a little bit about your insights from the travels you've recently undertaken in Minnesota, and perhaps maybe stitch in some of the other insights that you've garnered from both Trey Gowdy's letter to the State Department and, for that matter, Senator Jeff Sessions' committee hearing recently on what's been coming out of Central America and mutations to our policies as a result of that.
Right. I think one of the most important things I would like to leave your listeners with on this whole subject, whether it's Minnesota or South Carolina or one of the other 190-plus places in the United States where refugees are being literally dropped off, is that citizens and local communities are entitled to have all the facts in advance. Who is coming? Who's paying for it? Where are they going to work? And all of those kinds of questions need to be asked and answered in these communities, again, whether Spartanburg or the towns in Minnesota. Unfortunately, for the towns in Minnesota, this has been going on for a couple of decades, and nobody ever apparently asked the question. The local elected officials didn't ask the questions. Why is this happening? Who's bringing them? And so on and so forth. So unfortunately, their population of needy refugees, and of course their population now of prospective jihadists who we know from the Somali community are leaving Minnesota to join al-Shabaab or ISIS. The communities are so far along, I don't know if there's much hope, I'm sad to say, for Minnesota in this regard. Spartanburg still has a chance. Rep. Trey Gowdy's letter. Everybody should look it up. It's a fabulous letter. I have, in these 8 years, I have never seen a elected official take that kind of a strong stand, ask those same questions every town is asking.
And is entitled to have answers to, as you say. And it will be interesting to see whether the chairman of the Oversight Committee gets answers to these questions when so many of us have not. And anything on the insights about what's being done in Central America that Senator Sessions focused on, not just in terms of that migration through the refugee resettlement program, but also whether this might be abused by the administration to bring people in from, say, Syria or maybe Yemen and other parts?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll get to the Central American thing in a minute, but I was tickled to see that Senator Jeff Sessions, in that hearing you referenced last week, did say that he has concerns for this high number of Syrians that is being discussed for the United States. The United Nations has picked us already 11,000 Syrians. They wanted them in here by the end of this fiscal year, which is September 30th. 11,000 have been selected by the UN for us already. The contractors, when I speak of the contractors, these resettlement contractors, one of them came, David Miliband, who heads one of them, has come out with a request that 65,000 Syrians be admitted to the U.S. before the end of Obama's term in office.
These are people coming out of refugee camps that are run by the al-Nusra Front and perhaps also the Islamic State. The Islamic State has indicated they're willing to use these immigration programs to bring in terrorists into this country. I mean, we are on notice. The FBI says they can't vet these people. And this is crazy. And your monograph, Refugee Resettlement and the Hijra to America, goes into greater detail than we can today on how this works. And I think the American people will be horrified when they discover what's being done in their name. And just very quickly, last question, talk about this New Americans initiative and how communities are supposed to welcome them.
Yeah, that's Obama's latest program. All the communities in America are going to be literally, probably in some way, forced to become more welcoming to the refugee. Well, let's just call them, as Obama Committee Task Force on New Americans called them, he called them the seedlings that will be planted in the soil of your communities. And you can bet there will be some punishment for towns that are not deemed sufficiently welcoming down the line on this.
We're told 16 agencies are now throwing their weight behind programs to, as you say, probably reward a carrot and stick, but also punish communities if they don't get with the program of welcoming these people. There's also, you've discovered private sector foundations that are trying to train local authorities to understand that they better get with this program as well. And there's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back and let us do it at greater length soon. Your book is absolutely required reading. Check it out, folks. It's available for free online at securefreedom.org. Refugee Resettlement and the Hijra to America. Keep up the great work at Refugee Resettlement Watch and come back to us again very soon. And I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.